Dana, you made a little tease in February with a coming soon or coming attraction for a grandbaby. Has that grandbaby made their debut?
Yeah, thanks for asking, Charles. She arrived on February 25th. We're super excited that she's here and she and her mama are safe and healthy and trying to navigate new life. And with that, that means mom's not getting a whole lot of sleep right now.
Really? How about grandmom? Is grandmom getting a lot of sleep?
I was pretty excited. I got to be the makeshift doula for the event. So I was up all night with her. It was a 30-hour long labor from the time her water broke until the morning after when
30
she...
30 hours?
Yeah, it was crazy long. She wasn't really in labor when her water broke, so I think that was part of the delay. Not that the whole world once saw those details.
Right.
But it's interesting because we're going to be talking about sleep today, and I definitely did not get much sleep for about a 48, 72-hour period. And of course, now I'm back in my own bed, so I'm comfortable sleeping. But as you know, many of our listeners know, when you're a brand new parent, those first couple days and weeks and sometimes months, you know, don't include a lot of sleep.
And for the rest of the world, this is March, and I don't know how you're going to get sleep during this month, right? You have daylight saving time begins here on the 12th, so there's an hour loss. St. Patrick's Day is the same week, so if you're enjoying those festivities, good luck. And oddly enough, that's the same day as World Sleep Day. I don't know if that was a good idea.
Yeah, I don't think that's a good idea.
So hopefully we have some advice to get kids to sleep on time with our expert today. Who do we have on?
We have Dr. Zhe Wang today. He is a professor and a researcher in the Department of Diagnostic Radiology and Nuclear Medicine here at the University of Maryland School of Medicine. And, you know, right on point for what we're talking about, he's going to be talking about how the lack of sleep in children can negatively impact their brain and cognitive development. He's a really neat guy. He's developed several software packages for neuroimaging, and he's even a board member and associate editor for several international journals and an ad hoc reviewer for the NIH.
Great. So here is our interview with Dr. Wang.
You're listening to the heartbeat of the University of Maryland, Baltimore, the UMB Pulse.
Dr. Wang, thank you for being here today. We're so excited to have you as a guest to learn more about sleep for those of us either with children or like me. I have a new grandbaby, so I need to understand all I can about sleep. You led a study called the ABCD study, which was published in Lancet Child and Adolescent Health recently, and that found elementary school age children who get less than 9 hours of sleep per night have significant differences in certain brain regions responsible for memory, intelligence, and well-being compared to those who get the recommended 9 to 12 hours of sleep. So we'd like to talk with you a little bit about that today. This research was funded by the National Institutes for Health, right?
That's right.
Okay. And before we jump into the study, Dr. Wang, tell me a little bit about you. How did you wind up researching sleep? You come from a diagnostic radiology and nuclear medicine background, right?
Yes. So it's a great, great pleasure to talk about my study. So I joined UMB about 4 years ago. My research is about the brain. So several years ago, I was looking at the Alzheimer's disease and the aging study. So one big component and the hypothesis about getting AD and the aging and brain is that, sleep has a big role. And that's the start of my sleep interest. And then I started to look around what kind of data I have. And years ago, I had a study of studying brain development. So so I noticed that there is a huge longitudinal study looking at brain development. So then I thought, okay, sleep, not just the interesting topic for the older people and aging people, right? But it could be a very important topic for the development of brain as well. So that's how, why and how we started, this study.
That's interesting. Well, with your current research, you are specifically studying sleep and children, right?
Yes.
Okay. And define that age group for me. You say adolescents, but what does that mean in terms of your research?
Yeah. So adolescence is a critical period for brain development, body development. So theoretically, I mean, empirically it's defined by age. So it's between 7 to 16 age, or, you know, that that period of time. Then the ABCD study, that's a huge, you know, national-wide study. So it started following the kids from 9 to 10 years old, and we'll follow them for 10 years. So at this stage, we would still call them as pre-adolescents, because they are still kind of, you know, should be treated as a teen or a young child.
Okay. And what year are you in currently?
The study published is based on the data from years of 9 to 10. And we also look at the data from, 2 years later. So roughly speaking, the age range is between 9 to 12.
And so how old will the students be once this ends?
The starting point is 9, and if we, you know, at the end of the longitudinal study, there will be 19.
And in general, how many hours of sleep should children in that age range get?
Yeah, so this criteria actually was based on the consensus made by American Society of Sleep Study. So they made the recommendation that, you know, young children should sleep at least 9 hours per day. So that's the criteria we used to define which group of children slept less than that, and which group of children, you know, who had the sufficient sleep.
And so when you first started out, how did you get your participants?
I have to clarify that, you know, we are using the data acquired by the ABCD study.
Okay.
We are not a part of the ABCD study. We are using the data from them, and we, specifically use the data to test some hypothesis, created by ourselves.
Interesting. Okay. Thank you for clarifying that.
How many children were part of the study?
So the ABCD study, I will call it as a parent ABCD study, right? So they are following about 10,000 children for 10 years. And the data we have access right now and included in the paper is about 8,700 kids. So we use their data from the baseline. So the baseline means the time when ABCD first recruited the subjects, the children into the study and the study to and acquired the data. So we call the starting time point as a baseline. And so they have two separate study, right? So one is annually, they will assess the kids like cognitive function and collect their hairs and record. And another part of the study is to use MRI to look at the brain structural function. So that is done every other year. And in our study, we use the data from baseline, second year, and the third year. Because third year, that's the data we have for the repeated MRI scan. And in the study, we look at three big components. So one is sleep, and the second part is the brain. So we look at the brain structure and the function. And the third part is the outcome. We look at the cognitive function and some behavior measures. So overall, we were checking whether these three components, they have some correlations, whether they are linked together. And so our hypothesis is that for the kids who didn't sleep well, sufficiently according to the recommended criteria, so they may have, difference in the brain structurally or functionally. And at the same time, you know, they may have difference in the behavioral or cognitive function. And so that's our hypothesis. And then we checked another kind of related question is whether this kind of difference will sustain, right? Because at a baseline, you may find something, but it's a big question for whether that kind of difference will last years, like 2 years. Both questions are very important and informative for either parents and the policymakers, right? So at the baseline and both follow-up, we found that for these two groups, you know, the children who slept less than the recommended hours, you know, they had less brain volume in the gray matter. So in gray matter, we call it the gray matter because neurons, most of the neurons are inside, you know, the gray matter. So in MRI, that part of the brain, you know, looks gray. So that's why we call it as gray matter.
Makes sense.
yeah. And, you know, their gray matter volume is smaller than the other group. That's structure-wise. And for the function-wise, we found that the connections between different parts of the brain actually change, right? They have significant change as compared to the other group. So that's in the inside of the brain. So for the cognitive function and the behavior, it's the same direction. So for the kids who slept less, you know, their cognitive performance, including like a memory or thinking or attention, a lot of, you know, aspects, right? They are significantly lower than the other groups. So for behavior wise, you know, the measure we use, including like impulsivity or school performance, you know, it's a similar trend. So they had much worse performance in terms of, you know, those measured aspects than the other group. So that's a populational level of finding. And for the second question, I just mentioned that we were interested in whether those effects can sustain, will last for a while. And then we took the same kind, you know, same group of children and look at their brain and the behavior and cognitive function measures at the second follow-up year. And we found this quite similar effects. And that tells us that, you know, the effects, it's not just the one time. They sustain at least for 2 years. And that's why, you know, it raises, you know, bigger concern of for how long this will, you know, last.
You obviously are interested in looking at the brain imaging, right? What other aspects of the study were included to measure those functions? I'd imagine maybe some self-reporting was involved from parents or kids, but were there any like tests or quizzes to see how these children would function as far as like memory and cognitive skills? So you can make that connection. Is the imaging telling you what's really happening?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, the data acquisition, actually, it's a little bit complicated. As you just mentioned, some data, they were reported by parents, like this. Right now, the sleep duration is based on parent-reported sleep duration. And the rest of the data are acquired by either, you know, using MRI machines or separate the psychological testing using the well-established NIH toolbox. So that's performed using an iPad. The children, they are instructed to do the psychological testing in a quiet room. And we have, you know, the ABCD study, they have a nurse and a coordinator just sitting aside so they can feel free to ask questions. Dudes are quite roughly about the same time. If imaging is acquired, the procedure is like this. You know, the kids, when they come to the study site, you know, they will first fill some form, and parents will provide additional answers separately. So the next step is to do the psychological testing, and then they will be walked to the MRI scanner room to take pictures of their brain, either structurally or functionally. And they do have some concurrent task of MRI. It's called the, when they lay down in the MRI scanner, they are asked to perform some tasks. Well, that type of task of MRI is limited. So they have three or four different tasks. Right now, what we studied is called the resting state fMRI. We are looking at when the kids are not doing anything, what's the baseline activity in the brain? So how that will be related to either, you know, separated or collected base function or behavior.
I give all the credit to the kids participating in this, because getting an MRI at any age isn't easy for folks, especially with how noisy the machines can be. So having them to do a task on top of that is a tall order.
I agree, totally agree. Yes, this is a bigger engagement, and it will be 10 years. And both the parents and the kids are, you know, highly appreciated for participating in the ABCD study.
You mentioned about the self-reporting, and obviously you can't be bedside by every child, all 8,000 kids as part of this. Were they given any sort of parameters as far as sleep times, or did it matter at all when they decided to go to sleep or bed?
Yeah, that's a great question. So right now, what we look at is the sleep duration reported by parents. And sleep itself has many components, like what you just mentioned, the onset of sleep, and also the total duration and the segments of the sleep. Some kids, they may wake up, you know, they may wake up during a night and then stay alert for a while and then go back to sleep. You know, for certainly we need a long, consistent, you know, sleep duration. Yeah, we haven't looked at the other components, and that's our, we are doing that right now in ongoing studies.
Yes, and speaking of ongoing studies, I'm not sure if maybe this one is included in that, but we were wondering about maybe how much socioeconomic data is part of this to maybe tell if a child in an urban setting may get as much sleep or less sleep than someone who's in a rural setting, for instance, or based on income level.
Yeah, they are... There are many factors that can affect the sleep. So one factor, as you mentioned, is the social economic status and the living environment or family. So we right now we look at it, but we haven't published it. You know, the results are quite consistent with literature showing that the socioeconomic is actually correlated with the sleep duration and the sleep, you know, patterns. And for other factors, like, you know, if the family have some, you know, history, parents' history of some disease, and there are some correlations between them. So sleep itself is a complex, we can call it a process, but it's also affected by many other things.
And so what is getting less sleep mean for a child in terms of short-term abilities and long-term abilities? Do you see an effect for these kids who are not getting what we'll call good sleep over a long period of time? Do you see that that's kind of cumulative in negative outcomes?
To answer this question, I have to talk a little bit more about the sleep function. So as I just mentioned, sleep is a process, but it is also a function. During sleep, there are many fundamental processes, you know, happening in the brain and the body. Right? So for example, in the brain, it's the sleep time that our brain is kind of vanishing, you know, the brain, like washing out some waste created during the daytime. It's also a fundamental part of memory consideration. There are many research published that if you start to read something right before sleep, actually that helps a lot of memory. So you may get a much better memory consideration because sleep is a critical part of considering your memory. And, you know, part of your experience during daytime is actually kind of refreshing during sleep. Right? So that's why you have a dream. And during sleep, of course, you have no control over that. So the brain is automatically refreshing, you know, the things you have seen and connecting to your previous memory and experience. So overall, they are generating something, but it's a recycle of what you experience during the daytime. So based on, you know, those process and function, yes, you would immediately think that, you know, if you have less shorter sleep duration and bad sleep patterns, the normal brain development process may be, you know, changed or disturbed to some extent. That's why in our study we found that, you know, the shorter the kids who had shorter sleep duration, they had worse school performance and cognitive function. So those are, you know, well known in the literature, but not by a single study, right? So the trend is there. And to answer your question about whether this will accumulate, right? So right now, there is no sorted data because the lack of a large study like ABCD. So ABCD will be the first one to follow kids for such a long time. And it will have such kind of data to at least provide the first, you know, kind of a crucial evidence for your question.
That's interesting. So this hasn't been studied for a long period of time before.
You know, there are segments of studies, like, you know, some studies, they are studied for different age group. Overall, you can draw some rough conclusion that if the sleep chain doesn't change, if there's the kids or people, you know, they don't get a sufficient sleep for a long time, right? So eventually those effects may accumulate. And the extreme cases of sleep shortage is sleep deprivation. Sleep deprivation is it's more like an experimental sleep, you know, sleep manipulation. So they would ask the participants to not sleep for 1 night or 2 nights, and the effects are dramatic. So basically, after the 2 nights or just even 1 night sleep deprivation, you can immediately see some, you know, waste or toxin and deposition in the brain. But that's, you know, the sleep deprivation is totally different from the normal sleep deficits. Gotcha. For most of the kids involved in the ABCD study, they are still young. They are just the short of, you know, 1 hour or 2 hours or 3 hours, you know, sleep.
I was thinking about, like, how long these studies have to take, you know, before we start to find very basic data almost. The name escapes me, but I was thinking of like when my sisters were young and I was young, like our family would be sent like, there was a very long-term like health study survey where like kids would get it in their teens and then it would just be mailed out every like 5 or 7 years. And I think we're just finally starting to get that data after all those, you know, years of surveys.
So let's shift for a minute and talk about what the data is showing from these studies and how that applies to like real life. So when my kids were growing up, I made a conscious choice not to let them have TVs in their bedrooms. Nowadays, I look at parents and think, oh my gosh, so many things that kids can be sneaking right into the bedroom the parents might not even know about. You know, I felt like we had control of that, but kids nowadays have the smartphones and tablets and iPods and iPads. And how do things like that, or at least what's your feeling on how do things like that affect sleep? And maybe if you have any tips and suggestions, you mentioned you're a parent, how do we kind of control those things so that they're not affecting our children's sleep?
Yeah, so there is a trend of getting less and less sleep for children and adolescents in modern society because there are lots of attractions, including like sports and, you know, the electrical devices. So regarding some of plausible procedures that can help kind of reduce this trend is that for parents or, you know, relatives, you can implement some family rules like no pads, no iPhone, no smartwatch in the bedroom. Ask the kids go to bed on time every day and doing more physical activity during the daytime. And then they will fall asleep quickly, right? So overall, you know, there are some very helpful instructions for implementing all these procedures that I can care.
Yeah, you know, it's just like taking care of your pets. They say run your dog as much as you can, and so the dog exactly. will just go yeah. to sleep.
Yeah, physical activity definitely helps a lot because you can, especially for outside activity, right? You are exposed to the natural light. And that's totally different from a pad or, you know, watch. So those electrical devices, usually they have a strong blue light. The blue light actually activating your brain dramatically. So that's why if the kids, they are using pad or watching TV, you know, for hours before sleep, they cannot fall asleep easily. Simply because, you know, the light activation, surely they will get additional excitement, you know, based on their content, right?
Right.
I had something charging in my living room. It was a new device I think I got for Christmas. And I noticed, and I could just feel that light even with my closed eyes. It was subtle, but it was in the living room. I'm like, there's something on and it's bothering me. And I feel it almost felt like the entire apartment was lit up, but it was just a subtle light. It was enough to bother me. Where you're right, we have so many gadgets charging, emitting little lights, little indicating lights that it's hard to, you know, get them turned at the right angle and just to black everything out. I mean, obviously the simplest solution would be for me shut the door, but so, you know, it goes back to, you know, sleep preferences. Are you someone who shuts the door or, you know, open door? Do you have blackout curtains? You know, little things like that.
Yeah, that's right.
And I think too, just having parents model that behavior for their kids, you know, it's one thing to tell your children they can't do that, but then when they see their parents on their phones and devices all the time and in their own bedrooms. Yeah, that's a bigger, I guess, broader topic.
Yeah, I totally agree. You know, the parents actually are the best examples. if you limit your behavior, at least, you know, before sleep time, right? So the kids, the children will follow. And if you just kind of ask them or, you know, you force them to do something, you know, usually it's hard because the children and the adolescents, their brain is still under rapid development. Their control capability is still not matured.
It's great that we're talking about sleep and kids right now, because sleep has gotten so much attention for kids' development that the studies on how much kids and teens should get is really impacting school times now. And so we've had recently, California last year became the first state to mandate a later school start time. The American Academy of Pediatrics thought that the start times were too early and high school should start at 8:30 a.m. or later to get enough sleep. And even here in Maryland, we're starting to see that change, where Anne Arundel County has changed their high school start times to 8:30. Middle schoolers are now going at 9:15. Howard County is also planning a change. So why is it better for students to go to school later sleep-wise? Are you seeing that, Dr. Wang, as a good step for schools to take?
I don't do much, kind of research on this topic, but to me, it does help, for prolonging the sleep duration. I would just, provide evidence. So, for example, during the COVID-19 pandemic, right? So the kids did not need to wake up early because the Zoom meeting or Zoom class always start like 9 o'clock or even 9:30. So based on, based on the data, even from ABCD, we observed that, during pandemic, roughly speaking, the kids, they get a 1 hour or 1.5 hour longer sleep durations. So that's evidence I can see. Some reasons I can see is that especially for teenagers, adolescents, right? They have some coursework to do at home, and they cannot easily change their sleep onset time, quickly. So if they have to wake up early, especially to take the school bus, if the school starts at 7, they would probably have to wake up at 5:30 or 6 o'clock, right? So that kind of preparation, it's part of that. It will take part of the sleep time.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see how this unfolds, because I'm sure, as you've seen in the data that you get, sleep is impacted by all sorts of variables, right? And so for these high school students, I can imagine, like during the COVID times, they're not getting to participate in those extracurriculars that would eat into their night, or be able to maybe work jobs because of employment impacts during COVID. And now that's returned. And so how do they balance now a later start time with sports and working maybe a part-time job for a few hours at night? So it'd be really interesting to see what happens. But I guess for your case, even though you're not studying that, maybe these long-term studies, you're going to have to say, well, wait, we've been measuring these kids' sleep and cognitive abilities, and now we have the subset of populations that we've studied where they had changed their school start times, and look at the impacts of that on cognitive development.
Yeah, you're definitely right. And actually, we are looking at that effects, because the pandemic perfectly kind of implement experimental sleep modulation, right? Because the data is clear. So during pandemic, the children, they get more sleep. And before, it's just regular school time. And they, on average, their sleep duration is shorter. And now when the, when the school reopened and the ABCD study is still collecting data. So once the new data is here, we can compare how this kind of, accidental manipulation will affect, you know, the sleep and brain and cognitive function and behavior. Yeah, that will be a very important study.
I can't wait to see it. And you've been so filled with information. You know, is there maybe a study that you're working on now that you want to tease for us to look out for?
Yeah, so one study we look at right now is it's to kind of replicate the study we just did based on the parent report, sleep duration. So in a subset of ABCD cohort, they have additional data collected using smartwatch. And that's a direct, more objective measurement of sleep duration. And, you know, compared to the parent reported sleep duration, right, it's more accurate, definitely, because this is directly collected from the, you know, from the rest of the children. Now we're using that data to provide a more accurate and a more objective evaluation of the sleep effects on the brain. And we almost finished half of the study. Another study is to look at the family environment and the living environment, socioeconomic effects, and on the sleep and also brain behavior. So, you know, sleep is not a factor by itself. It is affected by other things, right?
Right.
And most likely, as we show in the paper, you know, sleep affects, you know, behavior and the cognition. But the cognition and the behavior, they will retrospectively affect the sleep. So it's bi-directional. So we want to look at, you know, how other factors, more upstream factors, will play a role in this chain reaction. So overall, we can have a much better, you know, more comprehensive of, you know, brain development and in under the modulation of sleep and other, you know, factors.
About that smartwatch study where sleep is being measured, do the participants get a free Fitbit or Apple Watch, or are they just supplying it themselves?
Yeah, that's ABCD. As long as I know, no free. they will have to return.
Yeah. Oh, okay. So they're on loan. I got it.
Yeah.
Well, that's great that you can pull other data from this study to use to look at different, different elements.
Yeah. Meanwhile, you know, to encourage the kids to participate. The study for a long time consistently, right? ABCD do provide, you know, some compensations, you know, to just compensate them, their time, and to encourage them to keep on the study.
Yeah. Well, I wouldn't mind being compensated a free mattress.
Oh, that's a whole nother study.
Yeah.
Maybe we need to have a mattress person one to talk about the effects of sleep based on the type of mattress. Well, Dr. Wang, thank you so much for your time today and sharing all of your knowledge and expertise. It's been very interesting just knowing that this big ABC study has been taking place, that it's ongoing, but also more interesting to understand how that data is used and what kind of outcomes you're seeing for the children. So thank you for sharing.
It's my great prayer. Thank you.
You may have noticed there was one less voice today in today's Pulse. That's because we have some bittersweet news about Jenna Frick.
Yeah, our co-host Jenna has moved on to newer pastures. She's taken a position with a different organization. We're going to certainly miss her, her outgoing and bubbly personality. She's always one who had great questions for our guests, and she's certainly going to be missed, but we wish her the best of luck. She's making a great move for her career. So, Jenna, if you're listening, we miss you, and we can't wait to hear how your new gig's going.
Best of luck, Jenna.
The UMB Pulse with Charles Chalet, Dana Rampola, and Jenna Frick is a UMB Office of Communications and Public Affairs production. Edited by Charles Chalet, sound engineering by Jenna Frick, marketing by Dana Rampola.